This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Good evening, listeners, brave navigators of the enigmatic and the concealed. Have you ever felt the pull of the unanswered, the allure of the mysteries that shroud our existence? For more than a decade, a unique comic publisher has dared to dive into these mysteries, unafraid of the secrets they might uncover. This audacious entity is Paranoid American. Welcome to the mystifying universe of the Paranoid American podcast.
Launched in the year 2012, Paranoid American has been on a mission to decipher the encrypted secrets of our world. From the unnerving enigma of MKUltra mind control to the clandestine assemblies of secret societies. From the awe-inspiring frontiers of forbidden technology to the arcane patterns of occult symbols in our very own pop culture. They have committed to unveiling the concealed realities that lie just beneath the surface. Join us as we navigate these intricate landscapes, decoding the hidden scripts of our society and challenging the accepted perceptions of reality.
Folks, I've got a big problem on my hands. There's a company called Paranoid American making all these funny memes and comics. Now, I'm a fair guy. I believe in free speech, as long as it doesn't cross the line. And if these AI-generated memes dare to make fun of me, they're crossing the line.
This is your expedition into the realm of the extraordinary, the secret, the shrouded. Come with us as we sift through the world's grand mysteries, question the standardized narratives, and brave the cryptic labyrinth of the concealed truth. So strap yourselves in, broaden your horizons, and steel yourselves for a voyage into the enigmatic heart of the Paranoid American podcast, where each story, every image, every revelation brings us one step closer to the elusive truth.
Hey, okay, we got an episode here that is going to be special for a bunch of different reasons. And actually, it's going to be so special. I'm going to do something that I've never done before. I made myself full screen right off the bat instead of keeping myself down there, just because I recently posted that my Kubrick NASA comic that I know I've been promising forever is finally going to be here. This is a test print copy. I only got I think I made like 15 to bring to a couple conventions, and just to make sure that the colors look good and the story flowed right. It does. It's great. It's probably the funniest comic I've ever produced. And this was like a passion of love. This one took well over 4, going on 5 years. And it was supposed to be something that I just worked on in between these two other comics that were taken forever. I won't even tell you which ones those were. They're already out now. But this ended up becoming like a passion project where it became like 4 times the size it was supposed to be. It's like over 40 pages. It's going to be just like one big one shot, but it's all about Stanley Kubrick directing the moon landings and sort of has like office style humor going on behind the scenes, but it's got a whole bunch of really cool cameos in it. It's done by 3 different artists. It's co-written by Spencer Lukes, who also is working on Chaos Twins with me. So this has got everything that you love about Paranoid American in its biggest form yet, I think. I think this is the biggest anthology we've put out so far about a single story. So you can check this out at nasacomic.com for right now. It'll just be a sign-up. And I think the campaign will start at the end of May. So, and we've got a whole bunch of other cool stuff. The only reason I'm showing all this cool Kubrick stuff, this is the fake moon landing playset. And this you can find on ParanoidAmerican.com. I only made a few of these ones to probably go with the campaign for this guy. So anyways, the reason that I'm showing you all that is because today we're going to be talking a whole bunch about Kubrick with Alex of Crypto Kubrology. And if you're not familiar with him, you should be watching Sync Tank. How dare you? But you should be watching Sync Tank on Tuesdays at the live show that I do with Andreas Zerdes and David Charles Plate. And Alex pops in time to time. And when he does pop in, certain numbers will continuously coming up. Like 237 will come up. a whole bunch of others that I'm not as familiar with. So first off, welcome to the show. Plugs up front. Tell people where to find you.
Thanks for having me. Great. I'm on Twitter, the former Twitter X now, Crypto Cubrology. That's Crypto Cubrology, which is a pun on cryptozoology, which is the study of Bigfoot and all those sorts of things. So anyway, I'm also now on Substack, cryptocubrology.substack.com. I'm starting to publish more long form writing on the synchronicity stuff. And yeah, that's where it is.
All right, there we go. We'll take you off the hot seat. Now we're just going to be chilling.
Cool. Excellent.
So I wanted to just first start it out with like, how did you come on to Think Tank to begin with? How did you meet Zardes? Like, where did you come from? Where did you go?
Cotton Eye Joe. Well, I've known Andreas for a while through like Facebook, just social media and that kind of thing. David Plate, I've known for many years because I used to run with the SyncBook crew, which is kind of doesn't exist anymore, although the site still does and stuff, but the crew doesn't. So the new crew is Think Tank, and so I had to get in on that. And Andreas and David are old friends, and David knows my work, and he kind of introduced me to Andreas. And yeah, I think that answers that question.
That's awesome. I mean, did you get into Kubrick before or after teaming up with everyone? Like, was this?
This has been a lifelong idea. It's kind of a lifelong story, really. You know, but I don't want to make it a whole like story.
Oh no, let's make it a whole thing.
But like, okay,
I'm curious. You know, like, what age did it start with Kubrick?
Well, when I was a kid. And I just got really into art and stuff. I love movies. I love film. And Kubrick was, you know, for like everyone, Kubrick is like the top of the mountain top for cinema. It's just, his movies are just best. The best. That's a complicated thing that we can talk about. But like, that's the perception anyway. And so I was really into Kubrick always as a mystery, as whatever. But it was just movies. But then I started to... I guess it was I'm a Loose Change baby. So like I watched Loose Change in like 2007 and I started to like think about 9/11 and conspiracies and UFOs. And that just started me falling down all sorts of rabbit holes. UFOs was a big one. And eventually I got so far into the conspiracy thing that I started to see like a slightly bigger picture than the kind of terrestrial everyday conspiracy CIA thing, where it seemed like the totality of reality is somehow being arranged by more like higher powers. And that really, that, you know, I started reading things like Philip K. Dick, who had his 2374 experience, and that influenced me a lot. And then I sort of took that back to Kubrick, and I also discovered sync blogs, you know, because back then it was just like it was all blogs, and it was a lot of fun. Everybody had their own blog and they linked to each other. And so through that, I found the Wrong Way Wizard blog, who was my friend, Mark LeClaire, who passed away last year. And he had written a really fantastic dissection of Eyes Wide Shut. And it was just like a very detailed breakdown. But the crazy thing, he had what I believe is still the craziest theory about that movie. And stop me at any point if you think I'm like,
I'm not going to stop. I don't want you to stop. You going.
Okay. So, his theory about Eyes Wide Shut was that it actually, the events of the film are actually set in a world post 9/11. Even though it came out 2 years before. So the implication being that, you know, Stanley Kubrick had foreknowledge of those events in some ways and encoded them into his movie. But then Mark's whole kind of trip went even further than this because, his theory was more that Kubrick was the architect of 9/11, not just that he knew about it in advance, but that he did it. In effect, Kubrick did 9/11, like
wittingly.
Some people say Kubrick did the moon landing, and it's like, and Mark's whole thing was Kubrick did 9/11. It's like, so, and now that's a kind of a crazy idea, but it's sort of reflective of the kind of all encompassing synchronistic matrix that sort of surrounds this guy, so that it seems that like he's at the center of everything if you look at it in the right way. And so, yeah, the whole synchromysticism thing was kind of came out of this idea in a way of associating Stanley Kubrick with Saturn, which has been done, you know, in many analyses. But Mark's whole theory was that Stanley Kubrick was Saturn, like he was an archetype of Saturn or an avatar of Saturn. And so this is all just leading me to where I am now. And it's like, this kind of just threw me for a loop back then. I was just like, holy shit, this guy's insane. But at the same time, this kind of makes a weird amount of sense. And there's all this stuff that points to it. That's how I really got into synchronicity, because it's through that, or synchromysticism, because that's when I met David and Alan Green, who made SyncBook, and Will and Bill Klaus. Was another good friend of the show, Think Tank. And yeah, I guess. So how I got into Crypto K was that I didn't actually come up with cryptocurology. This is something that another guy came up with on YouTube. He's known as Sean Fella. His real name is Sean Montgomery. He's a filmmaker. He made a documentary about Royal Rife in the early 2000s, a really outstanding documentary.
Shout out to my homie Matt Rife. That's the blood lineage of Royal Rife.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's probably seen that film. So what happened was that Mark and I became friends, and then we had like a falling out, and he left the scene
over for Kubrick. A while. I won't pry. I just want to know if it was over Kubrick.
It wasn't over Kubrick.
Okay. No,
there's some other shit, but, so anyway, I was just kind of like, left adrift. But then at the same time, there had been this new website that had just come out called Cryptocubrology, which was Sean's website. And it was like, you can't see it anymore because it was built entirely in Flash, which is
hell yeah, like real websites back when websites were real websites.
Totally, like, yeah, totally, exactly. So this site was just like, it started off and he posted it, and it's just like, well, I'm gonna slow down a little bit, so I don't trip over my words. I talked to Mark and I was like, oh, you should post more stuff about Kubrick. And he came back to me and was like, dude, you should Google cryptocubrology because there's no point anymore. Like this guy's taking it to a whole nother level. I can't even compete with that. That's what he said to me about Sean and cryptocubrology. And I was like, all right. But I did eventually start getting into it, and it was just like this insanely detailed breakdown of Kubrick's films, like the deep, deep architecture. And that's when I started paying attention to the numerology aspect of it. Because before that, it was all just sort of symbolic, and I didn't do that much with numbers, although I remember, you know, like 42 was always a symbolic, like, you know, linchpin for synchromysticism.
Did you care about numbers at all up until this point?
Not really. I mean,
were you good at math?
I wasn't interested in math, but I was pretty decent at it when I tried.
You weren't particularly doing like math equations or into gematria or anything. No. So it started really, Kubrick, no. And then someone else's research about how numerology fit into Kubrick. That's what piqued your interest to keep like adding to this holographic model of Kubrick as Saturn.
Yeah, pretty much. I knew about 42 and about 237 because of Kubrick, obviously. And
where do those come from? Just for anyone that doesn't know.
That's a good, I mean, the answering that question is what Crypto K is all about. Like, why 237? Why did Kubrick put 237 in there? But it's like, Kubrick wasn't the first person to put 237 into movies. That's the thing. So is it
more than just the room number in The Shining? Because I believe that in the movie The Shining, the original room number was not 237 in Stephen King's book, but it got changed to 237. But is there other references of 237 in Kubrick beyond just that one?
Oh, yeah, there are. Definitely. It's a funny story with the origins of that, because the story goes, obviously in the book it's room 217. But then the story goes that the Timberline Lodge, I think it was, or the Stanley, one of those two, that where they filmed the story, they said, we don't want guests to be afraid to stay in this room, so please change it to a room. And apparently they didn't have a 237, so they just changed it to that. Now, that to me is a classic like example of I don't know what you would call it, but it's like, it's kind of a cover story, I think. But it's also a pun, because why is he changing the number? Because the hotel told him to. It's orders from the house, you know, which is the whole story about Jack. That whole thing, that story is like, the hotel told me to change
it. And he's a famous director at this point too. So it, to me, just a gut instinct, it's like, why the hell would the hotel not want to advertise you can stay in room 237? That's crazy.
Exactly.
Or 217 or whatever.
I think that's the Timberline, because that was the exterior shots. They were the ones that were concerned, whereas the Stanley Hotel, which isn't actually related to the film, so I won't even bother with that. But, so 237. Well, one of the basic things is just that 2 times 3 times 7 equals 42. And that's big because 42 is also in The Shining, like, everywhere, particularly on Danny. Danny wears a sweater or a jersey with 42 on the shoulder. And so if 2 times 3 times 7 equals 42, and Danny's wearing 42, and he walks up to room 237 and he puts his hand on the doorknob, this is all about number play. This is all number play going on. Again, why 237?
Is there a specific message that's being conveyed between that specific motion of Danny the 42 touching the handle of 237 room, or are these just numbers that are kind of keep popping up and it's just pattern recognition, or does that particular scene mean something specific?
I think the meaning of it really pops out when you start to actually sync Kubrick's films. So like, if you watch, like, Bill has a great three-way sync between, it's the basic one, it's just The Shining, 2001, and Eyes Wide Shut, I believe it is. And they play at the same time. And so when in that scene where Danny is approaching the door, is mirrored by the astronauts approaching the monolith, right? So, and touching it, you know, reaching out to touch it. So that whole aspect of it actually is implying, you know, that the monolith is a kind of door, or maybe is the room 237. It's probably the same thing. And that was another like example of Sean's hyper detailed focus, because he has a video up and it's called Kubrick's Time Doors. And it's like basically just a compilation of every actor walking through a door in a Kubrick movie, just like doors, 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 as kind of as an exercise. But then in the same video, he tracks the number of times that characters say the word time. Time, 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 just through the entire corpus of Kubrick, and he counts them. And wouldn't you know it, but at the very end of it, the word time is spoken exactly 237 times. And like, I grilled him on this. I was like, is this for real? He's like, yeah, I spent a year like going through this, like and counting everything. It's 237 times. So that associates 237 with time. And of course, Saturn is related to time, the Lord of time, essentially. And so, okay. So I got into, so then once I started to, I read Sean's stuff, but then I started to actually email him and we became friends and partners in this sort of thing, just going back and forth, like with these numerical syncs and stuff. But that's the thing is that we learned that application of number through time is kind of what CryptoK is. Number and time. And that's also what sort of synchronicity is when you get down to it. But I need to
music too. If you go into like the seven liberal arts, I believe in the quadrivium, that's how music is represented, is the addition of mathematics plus time.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, I don't know where to go from there.
Well, that explains some of like the backstory of how you started an interest in Kubrick through just symbolism in the movies themselves. And then you kind of had your interest peaked in the numerology aspect. And then that kind of started bridging things together. And you said something that I wasn't familiar with, that when Danny reaches for the door handle, that syncs up with, if you're watching 2001 Space Odyssey. So it's almost implying that those two movies might just be like different perspectives of the same story that Kubrick keeps telling over and over. Is there is there a theory out there that all the Kubrick movies ever produced are the same movie?
Absolutely. Cause that really was Sean's, the centerpiece of his original website, which was, I forget what he called it, but like he had a sync of all the Kubrick movies. He had like a video where all the Kubrick movies were lined up together and synced. And and then at the end of that, in order to like keep it all even, he reversed them. And so he started looking into reverse speech and stuff, and that was pretty intense. But that was his theory at the time, that essentially these movies are all, they are kind of expressions of the same story, but they're all based on the same numeric architecture, this underlying timing system that nobody noticed. And I mean, some people will say, oh, it's not real. Some people, a lot of people will, but I don't think it is. I think
what's
it
the
is
most obvious one, like if you just took a normie off the street that maybe has seen a Kubrick movie but they didn't even know it at the time, and you were trying to convince them like, dude, these movies have got like hidden messages and numbers and everything, like what movie would you start them with if you really had to try and sell it?
Well, it's, I don't know, that's a hard question.
Mine would be The Shining, just because of the scene that where Danny wears the Apollo 11 and like,
oh sure,
there's the theory that the 237 is the miles to the moon. Like that one feels like it's got the most visual.
It's unquestionably the most sophisticated, but it's also like a lot of the stuff that I'm kind of thinking about is way deeper buried. Like it's in the time code. It's not necessarily what's on the screen, but like when it's on the screen. So like I say, at 42 minutes or whatever, he's at room 237. Like that's a pretty basic but good example. But a really underrated example would be his Kubrick's movie, The Killing, from 1956, which is like a really early one. But in that one, you can already see the obsession with numbers and like time, because that movie is nonstop. It's just like, it's about a horse racing for a minute or in part. So you get like all these numbers on the horses flying by, and it's kind of hard to describe, but if you watch it with that idea, it's just like the symphony of numbers just flying around the screen constantly. And then the narrator is always talking about 15 minutes before noon, he was at this sports talk, and then 5 minutes later. So it's just always all these references to time.
And you said
time,
this is 50s, number. Right? So this is the point when you're editing, like he's literally counting the frames by hand, probably.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he was. He did that all the way up until Eyes Wide Shut, which he did on a computer at least. But that is a question about it. Like, you know, was he sitting there counting the frames in his little laboratory going, okay, I'm going to do 42 frames after 19 minutes or whatever. The question of Kubrick's like actual intentions is a kind of whole other subject.
Well, what do you think if we just cut right to the chase? Like, are you just exactly 50-50? Or like, for example, like, is it a false dichotomy to say that one option is that he did it intentionally and the other option is that it just kind of fell into place and he channeled it or whatever? Are those like the main two options, or is there a third one that I'm not even considering?
Those are, I would say, the main two options, but then there's one kind of murky gray area where he knows like the pattern or whatever that everything is going to fall into, and he's using that, but that's pretty speculative. But what was I going to say about that?
I'm just curious, like, what's your actual judgment call? Like, are you like, if you had to jump off the fence?
I mean, I would probably jump off the fence. Well, it's just like, I don't even know what I'm saying that he knows. It's essentially that.
Well, I'll say it. Maybe you can tell me if this is anywhere close to what you're thinking.
I'm somewhat terrified of making hard and fast judgments. So go ahead.
Well, though, we're going to get into them. I'm going to ask you to make a few just different judgments on some of the. You can say, you know, you're on the fence, but like sure. The same way that Aronofsky had the Pi movie, right? And Max discovers this like source code of reality. And he might not necessarily be able to control it, but like if you know about it, like, you know, there's pros and cons to it. And I'm just wondering, do you think that like Kubrick was a Max in a way where he actually found that source code? Or was he like a black magician where he was like injecting like magical numbers or numbers that and synchronicities just so that people would obsess over it or for other like, and I guess that's the difference between like wittingly and maybe unwittingly. And I guess we can consider unwittingly and ignorant in the same camp.
Sure. Yeah.
Make a decision. Gun to head.
It's a great question. Yeah. Okay. Gun to head. This is, I'll go on a limb here. Because as you watch these movies, not just Kubrick movies, but all movies, and you start to like gather the evidence and the various like tropes on display and archetypes of different characters, there are different archetypes that show up. Of like, this person is this person is this person, even though they're completely like there's the Wizard of Oz, but then I have this whole Substack going right now, which is kind of about this question: who is the wizard? Like, in parentheses, of Oz or whatever. So like, it could be Kubrick, it could be Crowley, it could be anybody. Like, but it does seem like there is someone pulling the strings, in a sense. With Kubrick, we know certain things also that he was extremely in control of his own mythology. Like, as a if you watch Filippo Ulivieri's series about this, it's very interesting. And just like how deeply obsessed with how he came across in the press, so that all these myths about him were kind of part of the world building of Kubrick as like a
like
god.
So when you say myths, the only ones that come to mind are that he would analyze the size of advertisements, and if they were off by a centimeter, he would call the
newspaper. Yeah, well, that's true, I think.
That he would listen to air traffic radio chatter, and whenever there was like close calls, he would use that as a justification of why he didn't like to use airplanes, which is why he like didn't travel by air a lot. Like, I guess those are the main rumors that I know. And there was one, I don't know if this is true, that he was shooting a scene in Napoleon and the monkeys wouldn't shut up, and he wanted to just like feed them all bananas, like an infinite number of bananas or any. Well, is this what you're talking about?
I'm thinking of the more stuff that's like, he's a 200 IQ chess player, and he didn't even film Napoleon, and I don't know what the monkey, what monkeys he would have ever worked with. So I don't think that's true at all. But again, I'm thinking of like this idea of Kubrick as genius, Kubrick as God, Kubrick as perfectionist. That's another thing. Like you hear, okay, Kubrick was a perfectionist, absolute perfectionist in all things. But then you go and watch a movie like Film Worker, which is about Leon Vitali, Kubrick's lifelong assistant. Are you still there, by the way?
I'm here. Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure I didn't die. Okay. So Leon Vitali, this movie, he tells a story about editing during Eyes Wide Shut.
There's a scene in Eyes Wide Shut where Domino and Tom Cruise are in her apartment, and it's a long shot of them on the bed. And there's a big lens flare in the middle of this, of the shot. It's quite beautiful and just very noticeable. But then if you watch Film Worker, which is this documentary about Leon Vitali, he's talking about being in the editing room on Eyes Wide Shut with Kubrick, and that the scene came on and that Kubrick apparently noticed this lens flare at this point and started just like screaming at Vitali, just like in anger, just like completely pissed off that there's this lens flare in the shot. And to me, that's just completely weird. Because it goes against everything we're told about Kubrick, which is that he was this obsessive perfectionist, which there's no way you're going to shoot 50 takes of a 3-minute long shot and not notice the lens flare. So somebody's lying, and it's Vitali making this up, which is possible, or Kubrick was doing it to fuck with him and with everybody else just for fun.
And I did go to film school for at least for a short while. And one of the things that I remember them impressing on us, which might have been BS, but that originally film, like that lens flare that you're talking about, where you see like the different globes of light and they kind of like move around a little APEC world, that originally was something that was kind of looked down upon as like an obstruction or like an artifact. But over time, people started using it as an artistic piece.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. So, and even to the point where it became like a digital effect that people would start adding into cameras that weren't as, like, that were so advanced that the lenses and the films and the filters like prevented you from ever getting a lens flare. But then people were so like, true. But I wanted it. So they would like,
want it.
Add it back. Yeah.
It's so true. That's,
it's an interesting rabbit hole in itself. Just lens.
That's flare. A great example of how film is really its own medium. And yeah, JJ Abrams is I remember when Star Trek came out and it was just like lens flare, like 30 lens flares in every shot. But yeah, it was right there in Eyes Wide Shut. And then Kubrick is always using lens flares. He did it in The Shining as well. The interview scene in the beginning, there's this big prominent lens flare from the big window in the back of the room that doesn't make sense, you know, in the architecture of the hotel. Like it's this bright sunny window, but if you follow along with the geometry of the building, it's actually just like a hallway that should be right behind that room. So it's like a spectral lens flare in this scene. So it's obviously intentional. But so when we get a story from Leon Vitali like that, I just have to just wonder who's lying, I guess. And
what about the Shelley Duvall story?
What, that he like traumatized her or something?
Yeah, that like he intentionally told everybody to basically ignore her, and if she had a request, to like not fulfill the request and kind of like gaslight.
I don't know about that one.
No,
there's an account.
One of the biggest ones that I remember as being one of the Kubrick rumors.
Yeah, there's an account on Twitter now. It's like Shelley Duvall fan, and she's been like going and talking to Shelley, and she's very adamant about that not being, those stories not being true, and that Shelley had a great time in The Shining, and that it was all exaggerated, which is another example of Kubrick, kind of a Kubrick myth being kind of foisted on the ring, of Kubrick as this kind of tyrant, as this saturnine, satanic kind of figure, where he's just interested in traumatizing poor Shelley Duvall. And that kind of came out of that documentary. Get
the best performance possible out of her.
Sure, that's sure, sure.
Context.
Sure, sure. And he did. I don't know. And that is the thing. And this is a sort of a question that it also comes down to, is the idea of Kubrick being a good guy or a bad guy. It's kind of a comic book way of thinking about it. But was he, another thing that Mark was central to his theory was that Kubrick was an evil bastard who architected 9/11 and was basically the head of the cult in the 20th century. And
an act like a real 9/11 or the tail wags the dog kind of 9/11.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, that movie Wag the Dog is basically like completely stage an entire war through. So are we talking, because earlier you said that just like Stanley Kubrick brought us the moon landing, he brought us 9/11. So I wonder, does that mean he just staged both of them or?
Oh, well, that's an literal or? Yeah, I mean, he could have staged them as sort of, certainly 9/11 was staged. I mean, it was a staged thing, even though I'm not saying that that people didn't die or that like there wasn't damage or anything like that, but it was some people call it a ritual, mega ritual.
Like if we were to explore that concept that Stanley Kubrick himself had involvement or planned it, like, are we talking that the plans go from Kubrick to Cheney to Bush to Rumsfeld, like down?
Well,
how is that disseminated?
That would be, I see, this is like Joseph Farrell, my favorite guy, says this is way out on the end of the twig.
Let's do it, man.
Speculation.
This is the only place to do it, so let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that people like that Kubrick would be at a place on the food chain that the Cheneys and that wouldn't even have any clue, honestly. They would be more like foot soldiers.
Who would he be his second in command? Or who would he report to? Or is he literally Saturn, like the god?
The aliens. That's the other aspect. Like, you remember that movie Dark City?
Vaguely, it's where like the whole city goes to sleep and they go and they like reposition everybody.
Yeah, it's this total Gnostic, demiurgic, Saturnine story about like
a pre-Matrix almost.
It came out before the Matrix. It's about like basically the archons that rearrange our world while we sleep. But there's one character who is played by Kiefer Sutherland in there, and he's like the mad doctor. He's the guy that he's kind of like the human liaison between the archons and the human beings, and he's sort of interfacing between them and sort of helping them. But then at the end of the film, he's the one that like injects something into the into whatever their machinery is that starts to wake people up, I think. So in a way, for a long time I've thought about the possibility of Kubrick in that sense of like a double agent on the level of that, like interdimensional double agent of some kind.
Do you think that was Joe Rogan's energy drink that he put into the cogs to wake everybody up?
Yeah, it must have been. Yeah, that's the good stuff.
I agree.
Stuff.
Like Alpha Brain? Link below?
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. Yeah, actually it was just like that Bob Marley drink. Did you ever have that mellow mood? It was like a
Four Loko.
One thing I wanted to say, you mentioned Wag the Dog. What's the director's name in that one?
It was Stanley. A nod to Stanley Kubrick, was it not?
Yeah, I mean, it must have been. Must have been.
Okay, I mean, so that kind of is Stanley Kubrick being the orchestrator of all this. And I was also asking, like, does he answer to somebody? Does it go up from Kubrick? Or are these theories literally, like, he is the god Saturn and he is the demiurge?
I think this is kind of where cryptocubrology kind of comes in and like starts to sort of sift through all these things and like kind of come to some kind of conclusion based on like evidence. And that's where you kind of go into the whole, I think, being John Malkovich aspect of it. Which is, have you seen Being John Malkovich?
Yeah. This is where John Cusack finds like a door, him and Cameron Diaz in a really weird wig, mm-hmm. but they find a door that leads them to the brain of John Malkovich, and then they get to live like him for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes or something.
Yeah, they get to be him for 15 minutes, and then they're spit out onto the New Jersey Turnpike. So that whole story is about human beings as puppets, basically. Like, it starts with a puppet show. It's about John Cusack as a puppeteer. And the fact that he's a puppeteer means that when he goes inside John Malkovich, he's able to be a puppeteer and to take control and not leave. And so then by the end of it, you realize that by him doing this, he's like getting in the way of this long standing cult who is using these portals and this puppeteering technology to basically live forever. And so, okay, the thing about that movie is that it came out 237 days after Kubrick died. And that's sort of like just one example of the numerological, crypto-kubrological behavior of these numbers through time. So,
does this imply that Kubrick was almost like an astral suit that like other people could channel into and use him to?
I think the other way around. It's that it would be that like this person or whoever's behind Kubrick is like has access to a technology where they can, you know, puppeteer human beings in any way they want across time. So how do all these things get in to movies in the 1930s where no, and that's where you really start to kind of see like, or kind of understand how this might be possible, because you go back into these movies and it's just so in your face that, but that at the same time, it's like, there's no fucking way that these actors and these directors were doing this stuff on purpose. There has to be something guiding them, some kind of force.
You said 1930s?
Yeah.
Do you have any examples like what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, it's a good segue actually, because it's the same story. Because so the whole idea of being John Malkovich is possession. The idea of possession and demonic possession too is filters into it. But this is like a being John Malkovich kind of possession. So, okay. In the 1930s, there was a movie that came out in 1931 called Possessed. And it has Joan Crawford in it. It's actually one of Joan Crawford's, I think it's her first, like her biggest, it's basically her first star role was in Possessed with Clark Gable. And 1931. And so if you watch Possessed, the first 3 minutes or so, there's a scene where she's walking back. She's a factory girl. She leaves her factory. She walks home and there's a train. A train goes by. And on the train goes by in big giant digits. It says 2037. So it's train 237. And it's chewing along. And this sorts the whole narrative. And what she sees is she sees high society being taken happening inside the train as it drives by, and she decides that she wants to be part of that and leave her crappy little home and go become a society woman. But it's called Possessed and it's got 237 in it. Now, there is, in the case of Joan Crawford, there is a unique situation, because there is another movie that's called Possessed. And it also stars Joan Crawford. It's like one of the only times in history of Hollywood that a big movie star starred in two movies with the same name. You know, it's just something that doesn't really happen, but it did here. So they're both called Possessed. And then if you watch Possessed, and this is 1947, if you watch Possessed, 1947, there's a scene. Joan Crawford's walking down the street. She walks, she decides she's in a daze. She's like in a coma or something, just came out of a coma. She walks past a cafe. She walks into the cafe. You see the address 237. So this whole scene plays out in the beginning. But what's really incredible is that if you watch the two Possessed movies at the same time, if you sync them, 237 comes on the screen at the exact same second. 3 minutes and 51 seconds, 237 on both screens, and Joan Crawford in both screens. And so the other thing about Possessed 1947 is that it released on July 26, 1947. which was, first of all, it was Stanley Kubrick's 19th birthday. And second of all, it was the day that Harry Truman signed the National Security Act, which created the CIA and military industrial complex, basically on paper that day. So you could say that like the country became possessed at that point by this entity, which is the CIA or whatever you want to call it, that. And from which we're still under. Oh, great. Yeah, great. Shout out. Yeah, so you could say that the country has been possessed by that same thing ever since. And it's all keyed to this weird movie thing with number 237. And so that starts in 31 and then 47. But there's other movies. I mean, that a really good example is The Shop Around the Corner. Have you ever seen that?
No. Who's the director?
This one. I forget the director's name, but this was 1940. It's got Jimmy Stewart in it. Okay. It's kind of a Christmas story.
Classic. I'm still catching up on my pre 1950s cinema.
Yeah,
there's a big world of it out there.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, usually The Shop Around the Corner plays on Christmas or around Christmas, and okay. If you watch that one, 1940 again, it's got Jimmy Stewart and Frank Morgan too, who was the Wizard of Oz. He played the Wizard of Oz, and he's in this one too. But if you watch The Shop Around the Corner, the whole storyline, it's You've Got Mail, right? It's the same story.
I love that movie, by the way.
Yeah, that's a great film. This is what inspired it. Or it's a story, the same story. So
Tom Hanks movie, but come on.
Oh, I love Tom Hanks movies. But yeah, so the whole center of that plot line lands are these two people that are communicating through basically pen pal kind of situation. But they're the post office box in which they place their letters is box 237. So the big reveal at the end comes when he says the number 237. He says, take me out of box 237 and take me out of my envelope, kind of reciting the words that she wrote to him. And she realizes the whole movie turns on her hearing the number 237. It's incredible, actually. There's a few videos on Sean Fella's YouTube page where there's a couple where he and I go back and forth talking about it, a lot of this stuff and more. And also, he shows a lot of clips from a lot of the stuff I'm showing in a video called, I think it's called The Open Secret of 237. There's a few of them on there. So if you want to like see this stuff put into action, you can check that out. But so yeah, 1940, that's 237. Another really cool example, and probably the last one I have from the 30s at this point, is this movie called Shush the Octopus. It's just like the octopus, which is amazing, you know, considering.
I'm just curious, is that a command, like you're supposed to shush the octopus, or is it like be quiet, there's an octopus here?
I honestly don't know. It's a really weird, strange comedy. I think it's like you gotta shush the octopus for whatever that is, but of course that, you know, I'm sure this is a paranoid American. So the octopus, Danny Castellero and all that stuff, which is on Netflix now.
Here. Come on. We're not here to promote that. It's against YouTube policy.
Okay. My bad. The octopus has a great thing where, there's a scene at the end where it's kind of a horror thing where, there's a nurse, there are babies that have been delivered. Nurse comes into the room, the door swings open. You can see the number 237 on the door. And then she looks into the cradle and there's two twins, twin babies that are like these like kind of horrible, like I think they're like old men, but they're also babies,
changelings, twins,
something like that. And then this is room 237. And then from there, there's a point where there's a woman who rapidly ages, just like room 237 in The Shining, the rapidly aging old woman. And so that's another thing that you could, it's just sort of, when you see this stuff in motion and you're thinking about it and you come across it, it starts to feel really, really uncanny. Like, okay, why would this number be on this door with these tropes, with these things being expressed in the exact same way in 1937? It's just, it doesn't compute.
Well, what's and the answer to that question?
I don't know, man. I'm not here to answer any questions. I'm here to pose questions. Well,
I'll be the judge of that. I say that you aren't here to answer these questions. Because I mean, in a very practical sense, right? I don't think I'm ever going to go down the 237 rabbit hole more than you are. And I don't know anyone that's going to go down the 237 rabbit hole more than you, or at least the people that you're citing the research of, right? So in my mind, Sean, until I'm off this planet, like, you at this point have more knowledge and more opinions on 237 and the roots of 237 than I'll ever find out of anybody.
I guess I am kind of the world's expert on 237.
So with that said, like, you can change your mind in the future, but you got to give me something, man. Like, what, like, for example, do you think that anyone at all had the resources or motive, or is it even practical that all this has been planned? Or do you think it's just like a divine synchronicity? Is it like a code? Like, is it?
My feeling is really, I really love Philip K. Dick and his whole take on his exegesis and Valis and the concept of the idea of the black iron prison in which we exist, and the idea that the black iron prison is like being transmuted into something else, or that we're breaking out of said black iron prison somehow on some spiritual level. And I think that it has something to do with that. I do feel that a lot of the time that when I'm tracking these synchronicities, that it feels like I'm tracking an entity or a consciousness or something that is arranging these things to be found in this way. Now, that is a pretty optimistic take. The more pessimistic take, I think, is that this is yes, this is evidence of a cult in motion, and that has been active since the beginning of, you know, probably movies in general, and longer before. But
and why leave and these that, breadcrumbs? Like, why?
Well, that's
like, if it's nefarious, why leave that's it a behind? Good question.
I don't know. I don't. It may be okay. So maybe it's not nefarious, but maybe it's communication with said entity, or that's another kind of far out idea that I've had before about Kubrick's films, which is that, or I shouldn't say I, because it's Sean and me. We're like a double headed Hydra here. But the idea that Kubrick's movies were kind of designed not for humans, but designed for an interdimensional like audience in a way, like when you like
make it, that you would stick in like one of those space capsules and hope that like an alien finds it,
like a beacon or like a homing device or something that actually one idea would be like an attractor of archonic energy, like a bug trap where you draw bugs in and then they get zapped, something like that, like a buzz zapper for archons. Kubrick's movies are, again, that's more optimistic. The chance is
it entrapped,
yeah, like, and they're the, but they or they're they generate this energy somehow for some purpose.
Interesting.
Draw them out, and that's kind of, I think, related to what the bear thing, subliminal bears, that there's like an overlap between what we call the subliminal bears and this archonic energy.
This is new to me. What's a subliminal bear?
Okay. Well, subliminal bears were a part of Sean's original CryptoK website. Basically in his analysis of The Shining, he determined that, basically on one level, that this is more obvious, that the bear the bear is a huge symbol in that film, The Shining, obviously, right? So you've got, there's a bear behind Sean, behind Danny when he's being, just all the time, you can watch it. So, but Sean went even further in saying that Kubrick deliberately arranged the mise-en-scene of the movie to draw pictures of bears that would only be like noticed on a subliminal level. Like it's just like suggestions of bears with the lighting and the colors and the shadows and stuff. And he got a lot of shit for this. Like,
are there any actual bears in the movie, like outside of subtle references?
Yeah, there's, I mean, like I say, Danny's being interviewed by this doctor. He's got this, his teddy bear pillow. So there's this giant bear looming behind him as he's being, he's like half naked. And then there's the bear rug. There's a big bear rug on the floor that, that disappears and reappears occasionally. And then there's a great scene, the scene where, Shelley discovers that he's been strangled. And Jack is sitting at the typewriter and it's in the big room and she's hugging him. And in the banister above the shot, the camera kind of slightly turns and inside the banister, basically in the spaces between the little banisters, they spell out a word and the word is bear. And that's at the exact moment where she's like, who did this to you? And it says bear. And it's very subtle. And, you know, some people will say it's not really there, but it's very apparent to me. And of course then the guy in the bear suit, you know, giving the blowjob at the end, Shelley runs into. So the bear is definitely all over that. But then Sean got just all the shit because he came up with this idea that it went deeper than that. And people didn't like that. But nevertheless, the bear is a huge symbol and it's something I talk about a lot. And I forgot how I got into it. Oh yeah, and it's related to the Archons, I think. That was his thing. Like when he started talking about that, people are like, what the fuck are you talking? Like, what is this thing about the bears? And it's like, it's the Archons, dude.
So the bear is an Archon?
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, the subliminal bears are the Archons.
What about the blowjob bear?
Well,
is that an Archon?
He might be. I mean, yeah, he's one of the ghosts, right? He's probably akin to the guy in Eyes Wide Shut with Sidney Pollack, where he looks up and he's like looking at them from the mask, and he's like the king of the whole party, you know. Maybe that's something to do with it. But that movie, you know, it's nothing but symbols, and it's impossible to say, oh, who, what is this? Like, you know, hard and fast.
Well, there's that movie, documentary/movie called Room 237 that's got like three completely different breakdowns of what, you know, the number 237 might mean, or what The Shining means. Not even talking about all the other Kubrick movies, right? One of them is that The Shining's about Native Americans. Another one's is Jay Widener's, about that Kubrick was revealing his process in the Apollo 11, or just the Apollo program in general. And then I can't remember what the third version of it was.
There was a Holocaust one too, where it's about the Holocaust. And I mean, And then you had John Fell Ryan in there too, who thankfully didn't have a theory. He was just like, this movie's weird, you know, like here, all the weird stuff in it. But, I mean, all those theories are true at the same time. That movie contains multitudes, and that's the thing, like, all of his movies do, and they're all tied into this history of humanity. And, in a way that most movies are just not, as deeply like connected to somehow.
Do you think he was human? Do you think Stanley Kubrick was like a human being that lived on the planet?
Yeah. Of course I do.
Like flesh and blood, everything.
Absolutely. He was, of course, he seemed like a really cool human being from what everything I've read.
Of course, I just never met him. I've never seen him in a room. I don't even know if he was a projection himself.
Well, you know, maybe it's true. Maybe he was the Wizard of Oz and just, the whole thing is a smoke screen. Maybe he didn't even make those movies.
Right. Could he have been a Shakespeare, or do you think that the actual,
he was Shakespeare. Kubrick? That's I would sooner think that Kubrick was Shakespeare than to think that Kubrick was a Shakespeare, if that makes sense.
So you mean that literally?
Well, no, not literally, but like, this is just what I mean when I talk about Kubrick as Saturn, you know, like you got to kind of like think about it on another, from a four dimensional kind of perspective, right? That the whatever energy is in Kubrick isn't localized to Kubrick. It's something that's more general,
right?
That kind of instantiated in Kubrick.
The best analogy I've heard to this, and I hope it comes through okay, was from this old Rosicrucian book from like the 1600s or something. But that if you imagine that, we'll just say God as whatever this like shared entity thing is, but let's say like this God energy thing, you imagine it like a big hand reaching like towards Earth, and it has like its five fingers penetrate, and you can see them, right? To most people, they'd see, oh, look at those five different alien ships, look at those five different things.
Sure.
But really, you're just seeing like the fingertips of this one big thing. So I guess, like, Shakespeare's a fingertip and Kubrick's a fingertip. And are there other fingertips outside of Kubrick and
Shakespeare? Yeah. Well, yeah, sure.
Kanye West, is he a fingertip?
Yeah, he's a thumb. Yeah, I mean, I think any art, all art really, is all human action really is kind of tapped into this thing. And then there, you know, there's sometimes it's like a tornado and comes down, and that's your Kubrick, or that's your Tarkovsky, or that's your
you can say Kanye West, even though I already
said Kanye West, that's your Yeezy. There's just millions of stuff, but let me think. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson films are really touched by, I think, the same kind of intensity. You're gonna have to throw out some names for me to spur. Well,
I'm wondering, are there any others that reveal like the same sort of code where we were talking?
Well, about seven. Well, like I say, kind of, and it's sort of, maybe sounds like a cop out, but it's like, it's in everything, and it shows up in the weirdest places. Like I say, in the 1930s and those films, and let's see. But
how much of it do you think? And this is just a devil's advocate prodding, right? Because I don't even know. I hate math. I've never really liked math. I'm okay at it if you force me to do it, but I still don't like doing it. Same. But like, how much of this is just down to having a base 10 system? And our brains that are maybe tiny in comparison to like a supercomputer, right? But how much of it is just down to a base 10 system where you've only got 9 digits to work with and so many combinations, so that 237 is just like statistically not an anomaly to find a bunch of times? Or is there something that's like, no, this number more than 238 or more than 239 has something to it, and it shows up more prevalent than others?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that just sort of ways in which, and that's the thing where I get into, it's not just 237. I have there are five numbers, which I'm officially now calling the five seals, of Crypto K.
Is this like the Kubrick David Koresh? Are you going to open another two seals and the ATF shows up?
Maybe. We'll see how it goes. This interview might start it all. It's kind of tongue in cheek. We've had different names and stuff for these numbers over the years. One of them was calling it a temporal algorithm, which then Christopher Nolan stole in Tenet. So I didn't want to call it that anymore. 42, 153, 237, 666, and 1776. These are these
everyone
five.
Everyone check your cards if anyone had those five numbers.
Yep.
Go ahead.
You're lucky as hell. So I kind of just like, I forget what the question I was even answering. You were talking about statistics and probabilities and so forth.
If there's other like auteurs out there, directors or musicians or anyone else that's one of these fingers that has these numbers kind of baked in.
After The Shining, it's kind of like you put them after The Shining and before The Shining, because once 237 came out in The Shining, people started to like use it intentionally.
Is there anyone that claims to be like the first one that started looking into 237 in the context of Kubrick movies?
It would be like probably Sean or me or Jay Widener. Actually, Sean and Jay Widener worked together before he started his deal, and they kind of split off, I think, because of the Subliminal Bears, actually. But I don't know.
What's so controversial over the Subliminal Bear? I guess I'm not seeing it.
Well,
is there something
question.
That's like, because it seems like a tiny detail.
Well, it probably has to do with, you'd have to have read and seen how he went about like communicating it all. People were just like, you're just making this shit up, dude. But they didn't really get it, and it was probably not.
They didn't know what the 2024 internet was going to be like. They had no idea.
Absolutely not. And that's the one other thing I should is that I think we've talked about it before, but that on the poster for The Shining, the yellow Saul Bass designed poster. That's where the primary subliminal bear is, where you can see where the face that's supposed to be a face of a terrified child. If you kind of let your eyes do the magic eye thing, you see it. It's actually the face of a little teddy bear, and it's a genius, like little optical illusion. And that's another thing where I think, did Saul Bass know this? Like, was he doing this intentionally, or did Kubrick just like, no, just need more, do more, just wait until it appeared? And it could be not, could be either one. But check that out if you want to see for yourself if you see it or not. It's fun. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. The subliminal bear.
It took me a long time, and I think someone had to overlay a bear for me, and then I finally started.
Did you finally get it? Well, most people see it pretty quickly.
I can't do magic eyes either. Like, I've never been able to do a single one.
Yeah, I understand. So trying to think of what else what I've sounded.
Well, we were talking before about like one of the more obvious Kubrick films, and we went into how like deep and a lot of them like connect to each other. But like, for example, is there anything in Barry Lyndon that stands out? Is there anything in Dr. Strangelove that stands out as part of this like synchronicity?
Oh, well, sure. Barry Lyndon's a tough one because it's so subtle. But a pretty amazing one thing that happened is that recently, well, it's something that interesting to note first is that he used, on Barry Lyndon, he used the lenses that were developed by NASA to film the moon in order to film his low light candlelight scenes. And so that's another slight little clue to say like, okay, how did this guy get these NASA lenses? So he filmed that whole movie with those lenses. And something, actually, this happened recently that was kind of interesting. It's not really in the movie, but it connects the movie with real life, where the main actor is Ryan O'Neal. And there's an actor who played the Chevalier whose name escapes me. But Ryan O'Neill just died a couple months ago. And I tweeted about this, but if you do a midpoint on Ryan O'Neill, who is Barry Lyndon, the midpoint of Ryan O'Neill's life is the day that the actor who played the Chevalier died. And so these two guys are filmed by Kubrick's Moon Lens in Barry Lyndon, and then they go on to die in such a perfectly arranged way that the exact midpoint of Barry Lyndon, Ryan O'Neill's life, is the day that the Chevalier died. And that's the kind of coincidence that Crypto-K like kind of generates, that it's like layers of coincidence. It's not just like one thing. It's like three different things that all come in together at the, in concert. And it blows. And I have to wonder, like, how is it related? How is it that these two men were united through Kubrick? And then they have this relation through their lifespans. So it's just really weird. Dr. Strangelove is full of stuff. I mean, you got Peter Sellers in there. One of the interesting, I don't know, is this a sync when you watch the movies at the same time, is actually because, okay, in Lolita, Peter Sellers plays three parts. And in Strangelove, Peter Sellers plays three parts. Now, if you watch them at the same time, I think, I'm pretty sure this is exact, but Peter Sellers appears at both times for the first time in both movies. And he appears in the same way. In Lolita, he's beneath a white sheet, a bed sheet, and he throws it off of him. And there's Peter Sellers. In Dr. Strangelove, he's standing behind a sheet of paper, a big sheet of paper, white paper. And he flicks away, and there's Peter Sellers. And that happens at the same time in those films. So that's just an interesting, like, why did he do that? What does that mean? I don't know. But, I mean, Dr. Strangelove, what do you think about Dr. Strangelove? Is there anything?
Dr. Strangelove is an interesting one to me because he mentions how fluoride is being used by like the commies to kind of like brainwash us all. Yeah. And man, that one sticks out to me just because there's a lot of people that cite it as Stanley Kubrick's sarcasm against like how afraid everyone was and that they would just come up with these wild conspiracy theories. But mm-hmm. then like the other part of me, which I probably lean more towards, is like, no, like he was actually letting us know that the communists are trying to brainwash us with fluoride. Mm-hmm. It's really happening.
Yeah, sure.
And
the other option there is that he is bragging about it, that he's involved with it and he's bragging about it. Just throwing that out there as a possibility.
What's his motive as an evil Stanley Kubrick? Did Superman accidentally throw a barn on his parents or something? And he's like the ultimate.
I don't know, man. It's just
the Antichrist.
Well, that's another like I've imagined like kind of a book where it's like different subjects of like Stanley Kubrick is God. Stanley Kubrick is Saturn. Kim Kubrick is Jesus. Stanley Kubrick is the Antichrist. Could be all these things. Yeah, I mean, I guess the idea that he's just an evil guy. He's just evil. It's called Evil Kid, as the Mystery Science Theater kids say. It's kind of like asking why is the evil cult so evil? It's like, well, it's just because they are, and they want to destroy humanity, or they want to keep us entrapped.
Well, I mean, I feel like evil zoo. Kubrick did torture Shelley Duvall.
Evil Kubrick definitely did torture Shelley Duvall.
Also a benevolent Kubrick. Is there in a woo-woo?
He might have been bipolar. He could have been bipolar.
Yeah, like could he have both mistreated Shelley Duvall and also not mistreated Shelley Duvall in like a Schrodinger's Kubrick?
Definitely. That would probably seem to be likely, you know.
Like the
more likely
observing it
just because life is complicated and they were doing that for a year and sometimes he was nice and sometimes he was mean, but they all worked it out and they got a great movie out of it. But
what do you think what do you think happened with Eyes Wide Shut? Because I've heard a lot of the rumors is that this movie, he revealed too much and he went right. and he showed the first cut and they were like, absolutely not, take this back. And he made a stand and they made him fall.
Yeah, I mean, that's a...
Is that like a normie? Like, is that like a simp approach or...
Kind of. I mean, it's just like, that's one possibility. I think it's kind of imaginative. There's not really any, obviously no one's going to tell you that, but there's not really any indications of that, in my opinion, because, you know, for one thing, if you just look at the guy, like you can see the videos of his acceptance speech right before he died. And from what you hear, he was just freaking old and the guy never slept apparently and probably barely ate anything and was just completely consumed with the work. And so I just really have no trouble believing that he kind of just croaked. But
that surprises me just that out of everything in his life that seems to be coordinated, yeah. that he would just,
well, that's a okay. I'm not done though. I mean, I'm just saying that it's not hard for me to believe that he croaked as an old man, but, and it's a big but, the day on which he died is so important for so many reasons, and there wouldn't be a Crypto K probably if Kubrick had not died on that day. It was the perfect day for him to die, for all these numerological reasons, and other reasons, like the fact that it was 237 days before Being John Malkovich came out, etc. So on that level, we've even entertained the idea that maybe he didn't die. Maybe he actually faked his death because he wanted to die on this specific day.
Do you think he's dead by now?
He's probably dead by now, yeah. But again, I'm really not much one for like totally kind of fanciful ideas, even though a lot of what I've probably said is fanciful. It's backed up by at least some amount of evidence. And the idea that, you know, he was murdered, I mean, you just listen to his family talk about it, and it's just like, and Emilio, actually, the really good documentary is S is for Stanley, about his assistant, Italian assistant Emilio, and he was the guy that found him. And it's just like, yeah, I'm pretty sure he just died that day. But so then, you know, maybe, but I say maybe he faked his death, but maybe he died intentionally that day in order to communicate this.
Or would be classic Kubrick to have planned that out.
Totally right. And I mean, and if that's the case, I don't think he would have done it if Eyes Wide Shut had not been done, basically.
Well, what about Napoleon, though? Because it seems like that was his true, like, yeah, yeah, that was going to be his magnum opus at some point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Barry Lyndon got that out of his system, you know, like doing the old period piece, and I doubt he would have done the Napoleon thing, but that's another aspect of it that's interesting, is Kubrick's obsession with Napoleon and his lifelong, like the fact that he had a whole room in his house on which was full of cupboards of note cards, and on each note card was a day in the life of Napoleon. So you could go and look up every single day in the life of Napoleon and find out what he did on that day, which is a very Crypto K kind of thing.
That's wild.
You know, like, I kind of want one of those for Kubrick. I might make one day, but so.
And then one of those is going to be like, well, today Kubrick went and organized his Napoleon card collection.
Yes, exactly. It's like a mirrored funhouse. So but yeah, I mean, Napoleon as a character in history is fascinating, related to this whole idea of Kubrick as puppet master, because maybe Kubrick was Napoleon. Did you ever think about that, or something along those lines? That's the reason for the hint, or that's the reason for why all these, because Kubrick wasn't the only one obsessed with Napoleon, of course. Lots of people were or are. It's just sort of a cliche at this point of like men obsessed with Napoleon.
Well, Bill and Ted was all about Napoleon.
Bill and Ted, yeah. And it's a time travel story too, which is kind of what we're getting at with a lot of this. Time travel.
Well, not even travel, just tendrils, right? Those are just
right, exactly.
Poking out.
Totally. Sure. Absolutely. But like things that, yeah, stories like Doctor Who, which premiered the day after the Kennedy assassination, which is all about Time Lords, and Doctor Strange premiered. That's a good thing. Doctor Strange. Yeah, the Doctor Strange, the comic book character, Time Lord, premiered the same year as Doctor Strange Love. And there's even like I used to have this as my Twitter banner that's like magazine from the 60s that said, like, is Stanley Kubrick Doctor Strange? Because of his 2001 work. And I'm like, I just love that idea. That is kind of the idea, in a way.
He commands reality and he can jump through timelines with like
something like that. Yeah. I mean, you know, this sounds all silly, you know, when I'm talking about it a lot, but there's something like this going on. I stand by that. It might not be anything that I've talked about here, but there's something to this. And I'm currently in the middle of publishing a series on Substack, which is about the connections between Elon Musk and Willy Wonka, using these temporal charting techniques, which we haven't really even talked about that much.
What's your Substack address again?
It's just cryptocubrology.substack.com. And yeah, it's going to be four parts. The first part is up and the second one will be up soon. And it's some of the best work I've ever done personally, I believe. And it's sort of like more where you'll get an idea of where the rubber hits the road as far as what I actually do with this stuff, like other than just talk about it. Because our kind of whole idea is like maps of synchronicity. Like this is a exercise in mapping time, basically, according to this little system. And it's pretty amazing.
Well, this is
okay. I'll give you just that was where I was going to go with this, was because it relates to the day Stanley Kubrick died. And the first kind of big thing that I got any attention for a few years ago when I started, which is this idea that basically the first fact, the crypto K fact that ever existed, was when somebody noticed back in the 2000s, somebody noticed that Kubrick died 666 days before January 1st, 2001, which is the year depicted in his movie, 666 days before the first day of 2001. And people had kind of that had been shared on news groups and stuff for a while. And people were like, oh, that's weird. And then I think it really just took until CryptoK and myself to say, well, what happened 666 days before he died? You know, like, and that's this whole idea of the parent thesis that Sean and I developed of like, you take two points in time and you find the midpoint. And preferably there's like a good numerological number that's like connecting them, but then you find the midpoint and then you can just kind of, that becomes a synchronicity and you can kind of look at it and study it. And so Kubrick's death day, and then 666 days ahead of that is 2001. 666 days before that is the day that a human being first lost to a computer in chess. And the computer was called Deep Blue, and it was literally designed to look like the monolith. So Garry Kasparov loses to this monolithic AI or a HAL looking computer for the first time in chess 666 days before Kubrick dies. And that's what happens in 2001, is a human loses to chess. Human loses to an AI in chess, an AI designed by IBM, no less. So, and that's kind of a harbinger of the apocalypse, actually.
Right. And for anyone that's not already familiar with that, HAL and IBM, you just shift the letters by one, and that's where you get HAL from.
Right, which is another thing they like denied, like, that's just a coincidence.
Right, there's actually, I looked up the math, and the possibility, if you just went by the chance of that happening, it's so astronomically small, it would have been more likely for everyone involved to have been hit by lightning on the same day than for that to have just accidentally happened. So
totally, yes, lots of that going on. So that was a really good example of a parent thesis and like an example of how this sort of thing works. And I published that in an article in 2015. And I think I did one more, but then I stopped because I was just like, it's too much. I'm not going to share this stuff right now. And I literally spent now 8 years basically working on it, like the problem. And only now am I really starting to like get back into writing and like I think I have a grasp on what this all actually like means. So I hope to communicate that. And I'm a much better writer than I am a speaker, let me also say. So yeah, this isn't my best venue, but I'm having fun. So
I look forward to the manifesto. And okay, I have to call it a manifesto since you referred to the five seals earlier.
Yeah, pretty much is. I'm really kind of going with that, you know, just like whatever.
I like it, man. I really do think that there could be like a David Koresh Kubrick connection that like could really make this thing blow out of the water.
Sure.
I gotta ask you one other thing too. I've got a segment where we're gonna roll into, but can you connect the Ice Spice thing to me? Because I want to understand it a little bit. You don't have to do like the full breakdown, but
I don't even know. I mean, you mean like that meme that we saw?
I guess my understanding was that Ice Spice was like, I probably have over half of this wrong, but Ice Spice was born the day Kubrick died. And then has the song Kubrick. No, is that already wrong?
Yeah, that's not. No,
or that like 237 days before he died or something. Or
well, no, she died. She was born on January 1st, 2000. So like the first day of the millennium, basically. And, you know, Kubrick died the year before. There's not any
So a year off of 666 days.
Yes, right. Yeah, you're off of that. So it's like 1 year before 2001, Ice Spice was born, which is pretty weird in itself because she's, I don't know, all these pop stars and Taylor Swift, like Lana Del Rey, they all have these weirdly charged birthdays. And it seems like to me, like, and my Wonka piece gets into this more, that like getting famous has more as much to do with when you were born than it does with like anything else, maybe. Like you can have all the right connections, but if you don't have that right birthday or whatever, it's not gonna work.
I always wondered how often celebrities have their kids born on very specific days for that exact reason, whether it's like cesarean or whether it's like inducing it or just straight up planning for it.
Yep. I think I'm starting to freeze again.
You're good. We can keep going.
Warning.
I've got a segment that I'm going to like rapid fire some questions at you. And some of them would probably work better if we had a reaction, if you want to like leave and come back.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to do that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Be right back.
All right. We got this segment where I'll explain the rules first, just so we can go right into it. But the idea is I'll just mention a theory or a concept and you'll just rate it from 1 to 10. Don't believe it, and 10 meaning that you do believe it. And if you have, like, if you're completely neutral or you don't care or you don't know, you can just say 5. And that's kind of like, you know, five. You get the idea.
Okay. All right.
Sound good?
Sure.
All right. Here we go.
Hey, conspiracy buffs, I double dare you to take some PCP, the Paranormal Conspiracy Probe. On your marks, get set, and go.
Okay. First off the bat, human beings have landed on and stepped foot on the moon within the last 100 years. 1 to 10.
7.
The footage that we've seen recently, like within the last few months, is real, and we're on the moon now.
3.
Dinosaurs.
4.
Dragons. Fire-breathing flying dragons.
1.
What about demons?
9.
What about daemons? Is that any different than a 9?
Oh, I would say 10 on that one.
What about like egregores?
That's like a thought form or tulpa or
something? Yeah, let's just say thought form.
Okay. Six.
A hip hop Illuminati.
Eight.
Jeffrey Epstein is no longer with us.
You mean like he's dead? Actually dead? Yeah. Or
he's actually dead.
Three.
Okay, well, I was going to say that he killed himself, but I guess that would be a zero at this point.
Well, yeah, no. Wait, I mean, no. Yeah, zero for that.
Stanley Kubrick was evil.
Six.
Steven Spielberg is evil.
Eight.
Ooh, one of the sponsors of this show. So sorry, Steven. We apologize for that.
It's
what about Christopher Nolan being at the same level as Stanley Kubrick?
Zero.
What about anyone being at the same level as Stanley Kubrick?
I mean, you know, he's not even my favorite filmmaker or anything. So I'm just going to say like four because... Yeah, he's the best, but also like there's plenty of great other movies that I would rather watch, actually.
There's subliminal messages in Kubrick movies, and just because we've already talked about The Bear, so like arguably that's already a 10, but I mean like the kind that is intentionally made to make you act and behave or speak differently, like to actively program you, MK Ultra style.
Nine.
Stanley Kubrick was at an Eyes Wide Shut ball.
Yes, seven, I'd say. So probably more.
Eight. Eyes Wide Shut was about the Rothschilds specifically.
Five. I don't know.
Fluoride does cause like brainwashing.
Oh yeah, it's 10. Terrible stuff.
Stanley Kubrick was a conspiracy theorist.
Probably, yeah. I mean, yeah, probably seven or eight.
All right. And then I wanted one last one, too, is Bigfoot. I got to know, what do you believe in Bigfoot?
Of course. Yeah, of course I believe in Bigfoot.
Like 10?
10, yeah.
All right, one more.
What about something. I am not a flat earther. I would say like two. I'm not a fan of that.
Okay, but you could be persuaded to be a three, and if you got to a three, you could be persuaded to be a four.
Possibly, it's possible. Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm like again, my friend Mark, who passed on, was kind of a flat earther, and he had a very interesting perspective on it. But so I'm definitely open to other like cosmologies, but the way the flat earth, the modern flat earth people. Their arguments and stuff, I just don't find compelling at all. I think it's all kind of NLP mind games. But anyway, that's
neither here nor there. Also sponsor, shout out Richard Bandler.
I know.
NLP seminar coming up this summer. Get your tickets
early. Get mad at me. I don't care. Doesn't matter. Okay.
And I got to ask, I guess, a parting question, and I'll let you plug again. But let's say that the Kubrick family or the estate or the Illuminati, right? The Rothschilds show up at your front door and they're like, you're going to stop talking about Kubrick. You're not going to talk about 237 or 42 ever again, or else. Oh. Dot, dot, dot. Let's just say that they do this, right? They show up and they scare you. Like who's next on the list? It's like, they've taken Kubrick away from you. Who do you go to next? To start tracing numbers.
Oh, geez. That's a really, I don't know. There is no second best.
Do you just hit rock bottom at that point? And like,
I think I would just give it up. I think I would just go
get a job
and work at a bank or something. yeah. No Kubrick, no.
You can say Kanye if you're afraid for the backlash. I understand he's controversial.
I've always liked Kanye. I don't really, but I've never really considered him in that role. David Bowie.
As a puppet/puppeteer?
Yeah. I think David Bowie might be my answer to that. If I were to...
Anyone living?
Maybe... Sounds weird, but maybe Lana Del Rey.
I'll allow that. She's got a Chemtrails album, right? Chemtrails
of the Country Club. Totally. Did you know there's a tunnel under Ocean Boulevard? Is her most recent. Polanski is another one, actually. He's kind of already in the second position. Roman Polanski.
Is he more or less evil than Kubrick?
I'm guessing more. unless Kubrick is the most evil. Then it wouldn't be. But if it's all just as it appears, then definitely Polanski. But they were really good friends. So, you know.
Really? Kubrick and Polanski were good friends outside of just being filmmakers?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they... when Kubrick was making 2001, Polanski was making Fearless Vampire Killers, basically in the same studio. And so he and Sharon Tate would come over to Kubrick and Christian's house and they would have dinner parties and talk. And there's an interview with Polanski where he says that after Sharon died, the only person that he talked to that was helpful was Kubrick.
Interesting. I didn't even know there was a Sharon Tate Kubrick connection.
Yeah. They were there. That's the thing. He was quietly just like there for a lot of different, like one person is Leonard Bernstein. I didn't know. They were like really good friends and they were like together in New York. Leonard
Bernstein.
Oh, he was like the New York Philharmonic director, like the greatest, the maestro, you know, the greatest conductor of all time.
That's just the dude that stands up there and waves the little stick around though, right?
yeah, that's the guy, but that's an interesting...
That doesn't impress me.
Well, you should watch Tar. Did you see that movie Tar? Cate Blanchett. Yeah. It's about a conductor. That's actually a movie directed by Todd Field, who is Nick Nightingale in Eyes Wide Shut. He went on to become a director and he made this movie Tar, and it's all about a conductor, Cate Blanchett, who gets canceled basically. And she's a devotee of Leonard Bernstein, or a prodigy of whatever the word is, protege of Leonard Bernstein. And so my whole theory when I saw that was that this movie was about like Kubrick basically, where, you know, the director is the conductor. And Todd Field is Lydia Tarr. Her spectral mentor who's dead is Bernstein, who would be Kubrick to Todd Field and all this stuff. So anyway, yeah. Leonard Bernstein, Kubrick, weird connections. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
No, I appreciate that. We won't take Kubrick away from you. I don't think anyone's going to show up at your door, but
probably not.
Just hear me out. If there was a group of men in black that were specifically going after people to stop them from breaking down Kubrick, you would be on their list. So I guess
Holtz follows
on that, right?
Yeah. I look forward to the day when they come and knock. I will see that as vindication.
They throw you in the drunk tank and like Bigfoot's in there.
Yeah. And I'm like, yes, I was right.
all right. Well, tell people again, you've got a Substack. What else? Where else can they find you? What else are you working on?
Yeah. You can find me on X, Crypto Kubrology. You can find me on Substack, Crypto Kubrology. Again, I've got a four-part series in the middle of being published. So check that out. You can look at the on YouTube, just look up Sean Fella, or The Open Secret of 237. You should find his videos. I'm on a couple of them and I'm credited on most of them, or most of the recent ones. And yeah, that's it really. Think Tank on Tuesdays. Maybe I'll show up. Maybe I won't. Who knows? I'm like Batman. And that's it, I guess.
Do you have a name for the book that you've been working on? Or are you still working on the name?
Project Crypto K.
Project Crypto K. All right. So if you're watching this in the future, then check out for Project Crypto K and maybe grab a book.
Totally.
It's going to be 237 pages long.
That's the plan. Yeah, actually. I'm fighting for more because I'm very long-winded, but we'll see.
All right. Well, I mean, I know we can get into a whole lot more because we only talked about like five or six Kubrick movies.
Yeah, there's a lot.
This is what I needed personally as
good,
sort of like the 101 course. So that now I understand the 42 and I understand the 237. And then it's not just from room 237 in The Shining. It goes way deeper than that. And yeah. Until we talked here, I've never heard that Kubrick might be Saturn. I've never heard that he might be evil. I've never heard that he might have orchestrated 9/11. So these are all really deep rabbit holes that I'll go down, and I'll expect to have you back on to like hyper focus on one of these.
Would love to anytime.
All right, man. Well, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, by the way. Yeah, just
I'll have all your links down below. So if anyone wants to find more about crypto cubrology and 237 and everything else, just click on the links, and I'll leave us on an ad for Chosen One. And where's my handy comic again here? Once Chosen One is out the door, Never a Straight Answer is going to be the big one that comes up right after that. I actually have one called Illuminati that'll be directly after Chosen One. But I just want to point out, like, this is the very last panel is actually talking about that lens that he got from NASA. So this is him wrapping up, and I'm not giving anything away. It's an anthology, but yeah,
sure.
As he's leaving, he's like, oh, and by the way, on my way out the door, I'm going to go ahead and grab this lens that we've been using for the moon landing. So you'll be able to find that at nasacomic.com, but only if Chosen One blows it out the freaking water. So here's a commercial about Chosen One. Buy a copy. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com. It's easy to remember if you just sing along. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com. The Chosen One. Yes, he is the Chosen One. He's got his own comic, and now he's got his own song. 'Cause he's the Chosen One. Yes, he is the Chosen One. Go buy a copy at ChosenOne.com. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com. It's easy to remember if you just sing along. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.